From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We all love the Oregon coast. With all due respect to our neighbors to the north and south in Washington and California, our part of the coast is the most beautiful. But of course, as we've all come to know over the past decade, this beautiful coast contains a truly terrifying threat: the Cascadia subduction zone and the potential for a massive earthquake and tsunami. Well, I've got some more scary news for you. A new report shows that in addition to these calamities, the subduction zone holds the potential for a sinking of the entire tidal plain that could usher in massive flooding. Today on the show, you'll hear from the lead author of that study and learn about this threat and what it could mean for our beautiful coast. That's next on Oregon on the Record. The Cascadia Region Earthquake Science Center, or CRESCENT, studies the Cascadia subduction zone, and a new report is out from the organization, which adds another threat to our coastal region. Tina Dura, Assistant Professor of Geosciences at Virginia Tech University, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Folks might be wondering, what is an Oregon talk show host talking to a Virginia Tech professor? But you're part of the Cascadia Region Earthquake Science Center, or CRESCENT, which is a center housed at the University of Oregon. Can you talk about what CRESCENT is?
Yeah, so CRESCENT is funded by the National Science Foundation. And it is an earthquake center, not so much a physical center, even though it is kind of run out of Oregon, but it involves researchers from all around the West Coast and across the U.S. That's why I am Virginia Tech. I'm also involved in it. So it's bringing together researchers from a lot of different types of subduction zone science with the goal of kind of increasing our understanding of what kinds of earthquakes and tsunamis can occur at Cascadia, what kinds of effects that they are going to have on populations. And a big part of CRESCENT is also to kind of improve our relationships with partners, such as local and regional and federal agencies that have a part in kind of preparing coastal residents for the next earthquake.
Okay. Before I get into your study, I know a lot of people here in Western Oregon have heard the term subduction zone much because of Cascadia, but could you kind of help us understand exactly what a subduction zone is?
Yeah, so a subduction zone is a very large fault. So it's where two tectonic plates are colliding. And in a subduction zone, you have one plate that is subducting or kind of going beneath the other tectonic plate. And so in this case, we have the Juan de Fuca plate subducting beneath the North American plate. And this covers from Northern California all the way up into Southern Canada and Vancouver Island area. So it's a very long fault. And subduction zones are the types of faults that produce the largest earthquakes on Earth, basically, because they are very, very long and they accumulate a lot of strain as one plate is trying to subduct beneath the other one and kind of gets locked and accumulates that energy. And so when that fault slips, there's a lot of area for it to slip because it's such a long fault. And this can create the biggest earthquakes that we have on Earth.
Okay. So let's talk about your study that you are an author of. And certainly for those of us living in this subduction zone, we've heard obviously about the potential for an earthquake and we've heard about tsunami. But your study talks about this idea that another big risk we should be cognizant of is flooding. Talk about the findings of your study.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, we wanted to look at this kind of lesser known, lesser talked about consequence of the next earthquake, which is that the land is going to subside or drop during the earthquake from between 1 to 6 feet, 6 feet being totally in the realm of possibility. And we're basing this on what the evidence that we can see in the coastal sediments along Cascadia. So I'm a coastal paleoseismologist or coastal geologist, and I use coastal sediment records to kind of reconstruct what has occurred during past earthquakes. And so we can go to these estuaries in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and we can dig pits and take cores, and we can see really clear evidence that these estuaries have in the past dropped down suddenly during past earthquakes. So we'll see a very nice organic soil that is suddenly sharply overlain by a tidal mud, indicating that that estuary used to be vegetated and happily growing marsh plants and then suddenly dropped down and was basically converted to a tidal flat. And so in conducting this work, I find myself standing in these marsh areas, looking at the stratigraphy and thinking about the next earthquake and how much is going to change the coastal landscape. And sometimes we do see evidence of tsunami inundation as well. So we might see a nice little sand bed right on top of the soil and then the mud. But sometimes we don't. Sometimes we just see the transition from the soil to the mud, indicating that the land dropped down. And so a lot of the focus does end up on the tsunami because it is such a catastrophic event that is definitely going to have large impacts along the coast. But the part that we looked at where the land is going to drop down up to 6 feet, that is going to persist over decades to centuries, whereas the tsunami will impact the coast and then recede and be over within hours. The subsidence is going to persist. So those areas that were close to sea level, maybe not experiencing a lot of inundation, will suddenly be in the floodplain. And that's going to cause more frequent tidal inundation, more sensitivity to king tides and these things and storm surges. Basically, everything is going to be able to, any sea level related event is going to be able to affect it more now that the land has dropped down so much.
Okay. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Professor Tina Dura. She's a professor of geosciences at Virginia Tech and also part of the Cascadia Region Earthquake Science Center. You talked about, you know, kind of examining the coastline, but also talk about, I think if I read some of the report, you know, sort of computer modeling of kind of, you know, simulating what earthquakes will do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So as I described, we have this coastal geology that we can look at to get an estimate of how much the land dropped down. So we can use techniques like looking at how much the land needed to drop down to transition from that soil to mud. We can also use these little critters called microfossils that tell us kind of how much the tidal range has changed. And so we have these really important estimates of subsidence from the geology all along the subduction zone. But that's just one number. And so we have an estimate, let's say, of a meter at a certain estuary. But if we can compile all those and then start thinking about as a whole, if we can see all this deformation, all this land level change along the subduction zone, how can we then kind of feed that information into earthquake models that can give us some upper and lower bounds on what might occur during the next earthquake? And so instead of just having one estimate from the geology, we can use these models to say, well, this amount of slip offshore can match the geology in all these different ways, because there's a lot of different places you can put the earthquake and the amount of slip and still match the geology estimates of subsidence onshore. And so we use the modeling to get a better picture of the upper and middle and lower bounds of what to expect during the next earthquake. And so we had kind of, we were considering not just the geology and not just the worst case estimate, but kind of that range of possibilities.
Okay. By doing your research, and I apologize if this is an overly simplistic question, but I'm just wondering, were you able to sort of see a historic timeline of these floods that were brought on by earthquakes?
Yeah, so with our geologic studies, we can go to some of these estuaries and we can find evidence of up to 10 or 11 instances of the marsh dropping down and going from that soil to the mud. And so definitely we can see these repeated Cascadia earthquakes over the last 6,000 or 7,000 years on the coast.
Okay. And then if my memory serves, was the last big earthquake in the subduction zone, was that like 1700 or something? Or are there different dates for that?
Yeah. So in 1700, we have what's commonly accepted in the scientific community as the last great or large earthquake at Cascadia. And we have really compelling evidence of that along the subduction zone in these marshes. And we also have a really interesting evidence in Japan that a tsunami hit Japan in 1700 CE, January 26, 1700. because they have historical records of a tsunami that impacted the coastline but did not have a parent earthquake. And so it's known as the orphan tsunami because they had these tsunami impacts but did not have an earthquake that was associated with it. And so modeling and kind of linking that to this coastal geologic evidence at Cascadia has kind of led to the understanding that the parent earthquake for that tsunami in Japan was from Cascadia. And so it's a really interesting story that kind of lets us understand that the last time we had possibly magnitude 9 or larger earthquake at Cascadia was in 1700. So about more than 300 years has passed since we've had an earthquake, which kind of leads to some, you know, perhaps the earthquake culture at Cascadia isn't as developed as somewhere like Japan or Chile, where they have more frequent earthquakes on their subduction zone, kind of reminding residents of the threat. At Cascadia, it's very, very quiet. And so it becomes a challenge to kind of communicate to the public the, you know, the possibility of a really large earthquake there.
Yeah. Help me understand something about the way that in this study that you did, finding that the land drops down. So the layperson understanding of earthquakes, as I do, it's sort of like I think of those faults sort of rubbing against each other. How does that cause the ground to sink up to 6.5 feet?
Yeah, so I might have to use my hands here just to show. So during, when the subduction zone is locked in between earthquakes, like this is the ocean plate, this is the shoreline over here, it's diving down. The shoreline's actually rising a little bit right now in between earthquakes, kind of where my knuckles are, because that strain is accumulating. The plate is trying to dive down and the upper plate is kind of being compressed and rising up. And so right now at Cascadia, we actually have millimeters a year of uplift going on along the coast. And that has kind of helped temper any sea level rise that the Pacific Northwest has felt up to now, because the land's actually rising a little bit right now. And so it's either kind of keeping up with sea level rise, or in some places sea level is a little bit faster. And so that's kind of your inner seismic, or in between earthquakes, thing as the land is rising. When the earthquake occurs, you have the plates suddenly unstick and offshore. So my fingers right here pops up, and that's what displaces the ocean water and creates a tsunami. But onshore, my knuckles kind of go down. And so with that slip of the fault, you have the land dropping down and deforming during the earthquake. And that's going to happen basically over minutes during the earthquake. So while you're feeling the shaking, that's when the land is dropping down. So this is going to occur very quickly, and the effects will be felt basically immediately afterwards. But if you were in a place that was very close to sea level, near mean tide level or below, and you know this whole earthquake occurred over minutes, and you might find yourself suddenly inundated. But there are places that are where you might not necessarily perceive it. But it's kind of the thing where everything will be lower, and then it might not be immediately clear because let's say it's low tide or something, but then the next subsequent high tide, it would be very clear that everything has moved down and the tide is able to reach higher than it did before.
I see. Okay, we obviously have heard so much about climate change and sea level rise. How does that sort of factor into, you know, the potential for drastic flooding in its on its own, but then also in conjunction with the potential for a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake?
Yeah, so we wanted to explore that aspect of kind of sea level rise also. And so we looked at just, you know, it's very hard to predict when the next earthquake is going to occur. So the first thing we looked at was, let's say it occurs today, and what are the effects? But then we also wanted to think about, well, it might not occur for till 2100, let's say. And during that time, sea level is projected to rise along the Pacific Northwest. Like I said, today, the effects have been a bit tempered because the subduction zone is kind of gradually rising. But eventually, the climate-driven sea level rise rates are projected to increase to the point where it is going to overtake that uplift of the subduction zone. And so by 2100 at these estuaries, we use the NASA sea level projection tool to look at what the sea level rise could be. And we found between about 0.5 to 1 meter of sea level rise at these estuaries. Every estuary had its own kind of value because the rates kind of depend on that inner seismic uplift of the coast. So between half meter and a meter of sea level rise by 2100. So if this occurs before the earthquake, you're basically raising the baseline sea level. You're already expanding the floodplain in these estuaries just from the climate-driven sea level. And then if you have an earthquake on top of that, lower the land up to 6 feet, and you now have a even more expanded floodplain than you would have from just the earthquake.
Wow. Wow. I can only imagine the damage there. Yeah. You talk a little bit about, I've read that sort of the Cascadia subduction zone is pretty gosh darn unique in the world. Can you kind of explain why it's pretty unique?
Yeah, it's very, very seismically quiet. And so that's, I alluded to that earlier, where mm-hmm. at places like Japan and Chile, you might see in the news, you know, earthquakes from time to time. And we had the big earthquake in Japan in 2011. We had a big over magnitude 8 earthquake in Chile in 2010. In the Indian Ocean, you have a subduction zone that also has, you know, frequent small earthquakes and a very, very large earthquake in 2004. Alaska is, you know, constantly having sixes, sevens, and 1964 had a 9.2. So Cascadia is kind of the outlier there in that it hasn't had a great earthquake in the historical period since 1700. So that's the last big event. And on top of that, it doesn't really even have these magnitude six, sevens that we expect to see at this kind of subduction zone. So there are other types of seismicity going on, like these slow slip earthquakes that are much deeper. And, you know, for a while, it was thought that Cascadia just didn't make these large earthquakes. But then we had kind of the geologic detective story of discovering this evidence in the coastal marshes, the sedimentary evidence, and the Japan tsunami that kind of needed an earthquake to for a parent, and kind of putting together that whole detective story. And we also have that really compelling kind of offshore turbidite record, which is another type of sedimentary record that we see kind of offshore in the canyons, where you can see evidence of mass wasting or kind of sediment flow events that end up on the ocean bottom there. And so by piecing that together, Cascadia, everyone's pretty much agreed that it can make very large earthquakes, but it is eerily quiet. And it would be, for preparedness sake, a little bit better if we had a few small earthquakes from time to time, just to keep people, you know, prepared and kind of understanding that there is a threat offshore. It might influence the way things are built and such. There's a lot of buildings in Portland, Seattle, and that have been built without being stressed by a very large earthquake yet. And so it's definitely a challenging subduction zone to sort of communicate the risks to the public about, because it is so quiet.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce you to the audience once again. Tina Dura, she is a professor of geosciences at Virginia Tech and part of the Cascadia Region Earthquake Science Center. You know, I know this science is important in and of itself, but obviously it does inform what we as a populace need to do to prepare, right? I mean, you're talking about something, and I don't know that I could even imagine what a 9.0 earthquake would feel like, but this flooding is kind of a whole new layer, or at least a whole new understood layer of the damage that this event could cause, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, there's already going to be very strong shaking. We have the tsunami impacts. Then we need to consider the subsidence. And it is difficult to kind of take in the magnitude of what could occur. But I think we're a lot better off if we are aware of it and can kind of prepare for it.
Yeah. Yeah. My last question for you is this. And I know that as the science stands right now, we cannot predict when an earthquake will occur. But in the work and the study that you do, do you feel like the science is getting closer to a day where we might be able to, you know, accurately predict an earthquake so that we could warn people and do a better job of saving lives?
I don't think we're near predicting an earthquake, but we do have some key advancements that are going to help us be prepared for an earthquake, such as the shake alert system, where people can get minutes or seconds of warning before an earthquake to at least be able to shut down important infrastructure and take cover or do whatever you need to do in the environment you're in to keep yourself safe. So that's a really important advancement. And I think, you know, the geology that we're doing, the modeling that we're doing gives us more information about where to expect strong shaking or tsunami inundation. And that's really important for preparedness. The geology we do can also help us understand better the recurrence intervals of earthquakes. So we know from the geology and from the offshore turbidite records that these very large earthquakes occur 450 to 500 years apart. But we do also see evidence, especially in southern Cascadia, of more frequent, maybe every 200 or 300 year earthquakes. So that's important to kind of put everything into context of, you know, how often do the earthquakes occur, and when are we, you know, how much time has elapsed since the last earthquake? There are some faults that you can do a paleoseismic study on, and they rupture or have earthquakes thousands of years apart. So we know Cascadia happens more frequently than that. So that's already a really important piece of information to be prepared. But predicting exactly when it's going to occur, we're not there yet.
Got it. Fascinating stuff. Tina Dura, she is a professor of geosciences at Virginia Tech and part of the Cascadia Region Earthquake Science Center. Really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this fascinating topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at kocc.org. The refugee program in America has been upended in unprecedented ways by the Trump administration. Monday on the show, you'll hear from a national and local organization who work with refugees throughout America and here in Oregon, and you'll hear how difficult and heartbreaking the current system has become. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.